From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Business and Human Rights in Hong Kong, we talk with journalist Dan Sesser about how Hong Kong is preparing to become part of China on July 1st, and why the stock market is booming in Hong Kong as civil liberties are being swept aside. Also, a new collection of short stories about a character who is phobic about, well, you name it. Buildings with windows that don't open, buses, cars, planes, dentists. Maureen Corrigan will review the book called Do the Windows Open? Then we'll meet the author, Julie Hecht. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Carl Castle. President Clinton today is proposing spending a record $16 billion in an anti-drug effort for the next fiscal year, and that includes $175 million for a major new national media campaign. A White House spokesman says there is nothing new in a memo about inviting campaign donors to the executive mansion. The memo indicates that President Clinton gave written approval for bringing in the donors. Some of the visits involved stays in the Lincoln bedroom. Mike McCurry says the memo, which is 2 years old, does not show the administration traded favors for campaign cash. The Senate plans to vote today on a measure that would release funding for international family planning. The assistance has been held up by abortion opponents who wish to deny funds to overseas groups that use private money to perform or promote abortion. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Release of the funds depends on whether senators believe the vote is about abortion or family planning. Abortion opponents argue against the $215 million in assistance because they say although they support family planning, some of the money goes to private groups that perform abortion. North Carolina Republican Jesse Helms.
You become a part of what you condone, and I cannot condone this.
But supporters, including some who oppose abortion, say blocking the money hurts the very people everyone says they want to help. Maine Republican Olympia Snow.
A vote against this resolution is a vote for more abortions, more women dying, more children dying.
The Senate votes today. The measure passed the House by just 11 votes. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
A prominent North Korean defector who was shot 10 days ago in Seoul died today from his injuries. The gunning down of 36-year-old Lee Han-young has been labeled an assassination by South Korean authorities. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
The mysterious attempt on Lee's life came just days after North Korea's chief ideologue, Hwang Jong-yop, defected at the South Korean embassy in Beijing. Lee was a relative of North Korean leader Kim Jong-il's former wife. He was alleged to have uttered spy, spy, shortly after being shot in the head at close range outside his Seoul apartment. Authorities say the weapon was a Belgian-made Browning pistol, considered a trademark of North Korean agents. A nationwide manhunt was launched for Lee's assailants. Nothing has materialized, and there are now doubts about whether this was in fact a North Korean-inspired murder. Lee, who had reportedly undergone plastic surgery to change his identity, had escaped to the South in the 1980s. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 18.47 to 6989.73. The Nasdaq is down 1.5 points. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, consumer confidence was down slightly this month after figures for January were revised upward to an even more dramatic gain than first reported. The measure is considered a sign of consumers' willingness to spend. The Conference Board says today's numbers were higher than had been forecast, even with the decline in February from the revised January number. The Conference Board is a private business finance research organization based in New York. The stock market has been mixed with the Dow down and the Nasdaq up slightly. At noon, the Dow is down 18.47 to 6989.73. Here's more from Bloomberg's Doug Krisner.
Trading has been volatile ahead of tomorrow's testimony from Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan before the Senate Banking Committee. Investors are concerned that Greenspan sees the stock market showing speculative characteristics. Retail shares are higher after stronger than expected earnings from Walmart, Home Depot, and Limited, Inc. However, cable TV stocks are lower on concern about growing competition from satellite distribution. Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation is entering the U.S. satellite TV market through a $1 billion investment in EchoStar Communications. I'm Doug Krisner.
Clinton administration officials are expected to promise Chilean President Eduardo Frei this week that they will work hard to win congressional approval of trade legislation to bring Chile into NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. However, administration officials would not say when they plan to send Congress proposed fast-track legislation, which is needed to negotiate an agreement to bring Chile into NAFTA without fear that it will be subjected to changes by Congress. Frei will address a joint meeting of Congress on Thursday. I'm Carl Castle, NPR News in Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the New Prospect Foundation for support of the NPR Endowment and the Indiana-based Lilly Endowment Incorporated for coverage of religion.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday was the funeral of Deng Xiaoping, one of the architects of modern China and of China's policy toward Hong Kong. On July 1st, Hong Kong will again become part of China after 150 years as a British colony. A drama about business and human rights is unfolding in Hong Kong. Capitalism is booming, but China has already moved to dilute civil liberties. Earlier this week, America's new Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, met with Chinese leaders and told them that Washington wants a smooth transition which respects Hong Kong's autonomy, freedoms, and capitalism. My guest Dan Sesser has an article about Hong Kong in the current New Republic. He formerly wrote about Southeast Asia for The New Yorker and is now Senior Fellow of the Human Rights Center at the University of California at Berkeley. He says that what's happening in Hong Kong symbolizes what's happening in a lot of Asia and the rest of the world.
The business community, the big multinational companies around the world, seem to be dominating now foreign policy. And the United States, when Bill Clinton ran for president in 1990, he was harshly critical of China on human rights. And now, in 1997, the Clinton administration is taking the position that, well, we'll mention human rights, but we're not going to carry any sort of stick. We're not going to threaten any sort of consequences. And Hong Kong is a place that has gotten a tremendous amount of newly won freedom from the British over the last 10 years. It's a territory that finally has a large degree of democracy and a large degree of civil liberties, and these are being swept away even before China officially takes over Hong Kong on July 1st.
It seems like there's two separate stories going on in Hong Kong, and one is what's at stake for business, and the other is what's at stake for democracy and human rights. Maybe we could break these down and look at how these stories are both independent and entwined.
Well, I think that China has very clearly gotten the message that you make every concession to the business community, and making concessions to the business community is a very profitable thing for China to do, and then you're free to do whatever you want with human rights, and you'll take a little verbal abuse, but nothing much is going to happen to you. So China has said to the Western business community operating in Hong Kong, go ahead and do what you've always done in the past, and we're going to extend every consideration toward you. And at the same time, China has been saying to those who value democracy and civil liberties in Hong Kong that we're going to systematically strip away everything that you've gained. And the feeling is that they're going to get away. Their feeling is that they're going to get away with it, and I think that's really true.
What's in it for China to make sure that the business community can operate in a profitable way in Hong Kong?
Well, first of all, a lot of Hong Kong business now is controlled by China. Chinese companies, many of them owned by the Chinese government and the Chinese army, have made huge investments in Hong Kong. And a lot of the Western companies operating in Hong Kong have realized that to continue in business, they're going to have to sell big stakes in their companies to China. So, for instance, Swire, the big British trading company, sold last year a majority interest in its airline, Cathay Pacific, to a Chinese company operating in Hong Kong. So the leaders in China, the leading businessmen, the politicians, leading army officers are going to get very, very rich from dealing with Hong Kong. I think that they look upon the business community in Hong Kong as a great, great asset.
It seems like while the residents of Hong Kong are bracing themselves to lose civil liberties, that the stock market is booming. Why is the stock market booming?
The stock market is booming, I think, because business feels very comfortable with an authoritarian government. What was happening in Hong Kong before, Hong Kong had legislative elections in 1995, and 20 of the 60 legislative seats were up for general vote by universal suffrage. And this was the first time something like this has happened in Hong Kong. And of those 20 seats, 12 of them were captured by the Democratic Party, a very socially progressive party. Now, the pro-Beijing party, even though Hong Kong voters knew that Beijing was going to take over their country in a year and a half, the pro-Beijing party got just 2 seats and just 16% of the vote. So Hong Kong voters were showing where their sympathies lay. And I think for the business community saw this as a real danger because Hong Kong has very low taxes. It provides no sort of welfare benefits or anything like that. Business keeps all the profit it makes. And I think that the stock market was, investors were more frightened by the idea of the Democrats coming to power in Hong Kong and maybe clamping down on business and maybe taxing business to support some poor people in Hong Kong than they were with the authoritarian rule in China. And there has been absolute euphoria in Hong Kong. It's just unbelievable to go to Hong Kong today and see what's going on. A friend of mine bought a 970-square-foot apartment. This is when I was there in December. He bought this apartment in a middling neighborhood, no view, noisy streetcar outside. For his tiny little apartment, he paid $900,000 U.S., and I just saw him last week, and he hasn't even moved in yet. The construction hasn't finished. And he said the apartments in his building are now selling for $1.1 million. So it's increased $200,000 in just 2 months. It's an absolute speculative mania.
Who's doing the speculation? Is it a lot of foreigners who expect to make big bucks there now?
A lot of Chinese money is coming in, number one. And number two is that a lot of Hong Kong residents who left, who got visas mainly to Canada in the early 1990s after Tiananmen Square, who were very worried about the future of Hong Kong, are now trying to get back and are trying to buy their apartments back and discovering that they have to pay 3 times as much as they sold them for.
You compare what's happening in Hong Kong to what's already happened in Singapore. An authoritarian rule that gives business a free hand, but not individuals.
Singapore is showing the world how to do it. Everyone laughed at Singapore and thought that Singapore was really an anomaly in the world. And now Singapore is giving an important lesson to countries like China and like Vietnam, which is you give the business community absolute freedom. And then you're free to clamp down on the rights of individuals to whatever extent you want, and you can remain very friendly with the West. In Singapore, for instance, an individual who wants to log on to the internet has to go through a government computer. And if that individual asks for a website, such as Playboy's, that the government doesn't like, the computer will reject the request. But business doesn't have to go through a government computer. They can get to any website they want. There's a two-track system. Businesses can own satellite dishes. Individuals can't own satellite dishes. They have to get their television from cable so that the government, if it doesn't like what's on CNN, for instance, can just pull the plug. Now it seems that China is learning the lesson, and the new chief executive designate of Hong Kong, Tung Chee Hwa, who was appointed by Beijing, has openly expressed his admiration for Singapore and Lee Kuan Yew. And it looks as if Hong Kong is about to become a second Singapore.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Stan Sesser, and he has an article in the New Republic called The Betrayal of Hong Kong. He's a former staff writer for The New Yorker, covering Southeast Asia, and he's senior fellow at the Human Rights Center at the University of California at Berkeley. Stan, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about Hong Kong. This is Fresh Air. Back with journalist Stan Sesser, and he's written about Hong Kong in the latest edition of The New Republic. Let's look more closely about what's happening with human rights in Hong Kong now. China has said that it would be willing to allow one country, two systems. In other words, one system for Hong Kong and another system for mainland China. How do you interpret that?
Well, this came in 1984 as a gesture by Deng Xiaoping when Britain and China first reached agreement on Hong Kong being turned over to China in July 1997. And it was a magnanimous gesture on China's part. And I think it came largely because Hong Kong in 1984 was mainly a slave plantation of Britain. China was very comfortable with the Hong Kong that it saw in 1984. There was no democracy whatsoever. There was a series of very restrictive colonial laws that the British had in place in all their Asian colonies that gave the British the power, if it wanted, to censor the press and to trample on civil liberties at will. And then after Tiananmen Square, things changed very dramatically. There was a demonstration in Hong Kong that was absolutely unprecedented in Hong Kong history. 1 million people poured out into the streets. And the British decided that they had to salvage their reputation. The colonial laws were scrapped. Democracy was introduced in the legislative elections. And people responded very positively. This meant a lot. This hit a real chord in Hong Kong. And Hong Kong became a very different place. So China found itself in the mid-1990s taking over a very, very different territory than what it saw in 1984. So it's a very different Hong Kong today, and China has simply decided to systematically strip away these liberties.
What has Beijing done so far to strip away liberties? And for example, it's going to disband the Hong Kong democratically elected legislature.
Right. And the legislature on July 1st will be replaced by a Beijing-appointed legislature, the provisional legislature, which is already passing laws effective July 1st that for instance, will require demonstrators to get police permission to demonstrate. So a fine chance the annual June 4th Tiananmen Square demonstration will have if you have to get police permission to demonstrate starting when China takes over. Requiring everyone who forms a group to register with the government and get government permission to have that group formed. There'll be a subversion law which will give the Hong Kong China-run government a license to throw any dissident into prison and say, we're just following the system of laws. This man violated the law.
China is also, I think, preparing to reinstitute colonial laws that the British had actually passed years ago in an attempt to control the pro-communist China left in Hong Kong.
that's another. It's a Singaporean technique again. If you remember when Michael Fay was caned in Singapore, and the Singapore government said, well, you know, you say that caning is barbaric. Who introduced caning laws into Singapore but the British? And so the Chinese can do exactly the same thing. All these British colonial laws were designed to keep communist sympathizers suppressed in Hong Kong during the years of the Cultural Revolution and whatever. And now these same laws will be turned on their face and used against supporters of democracy.
You know, I'm wondering if any of the businessmen in Hong Kong who you interviewed have a kind of dual feeling, like they're pleased that business will still be given a free hand, but they're concerned about crackdowns against human rights.
There's one supporter in the Hong Kong business community of human rights, and this is a man, an American, who lived in Hong Kong for 23 years. He now lives half the year in San Francisco, named John Kam, who's a business consultant in Hong Kong. He still works in Hong Kong. And he has... He was the president of the American Chamber of Commerce in 1990 and worked for human rights, and he's made 31 trips to Beijing to negotiate on behalf of dissidents and has had considerable success. And I asked him, I said, I can't find anyone who I'm interviewing. I want to interview one person in the business community who can speak in support of democracy and human rights. Who can I see? And he said, well, I can tell you about lawyers and doctors and small businessmen. But when you get to companies, say, over $5 million a year in revenue, there's no one. There's absolutely no one. The business community en masse has looked toward its own special interests and the huge profits to be made in the future in Chinese markets and has completely abandoned even lip service to democracy and human rights. It's a scandal.
How important to Hong Kong is access to Chinese markets? Maybe you could give us a scope of the market of China, why that's so important to businesses now.
Well, you look at China in any respect. One-third of the world's cigarettes are smoked in China, and virtually none of them are Western cigarettes. And none of the smokers are women. So the Western tobacco companies look at the China market and they say, my God, all we have to do is tell women you can be slim and fashionable by smoking cigarettes and we can addict all the women in China and have them smoke Western cigarettes instead of the Chinese brands. You look at the cars. No one owns a private car except for high officials and rich businessmen. And there are 1.2 billion people in China and a growing middle class. So. I mean, it represents the last untapped market.
How do you think the death of Deng Xiaoping changes the picture in China?
Well, in terms of Hong Kong, Deng Xiaoping, of course, was the author of the One Country, Two Systems policy. And I think that his death gives the current rulers in China more freedom to do what they will with Hong Kong, although One Country, Two Systems seem to be going down the tubes even before his death. And in China itself, there's not going to be any impact for a while, and it's going to take a long time to sort out. And the bottom line seems to be to what extent Jiang Zemin, the president of China, can pacify the army and keep the army on his side. It's the army that's the real threat to the current government of China, not democracy advocates, not dissidents. It's the army that represents the real threat.
Are you hoping to be in Hong Kong on July 1st when the transfer happens?
Well, I don't think that anything very dramatic is going to happen on July 1st. Everyone is going to... everyone's been asking the question, you know, will there be a massive roundup of dissidents? But I don't think that China can be that blind to the public relations value of at least waiting a month till there are going to be 6,000 foreign journalists in Hong Kong then. So there are just going to be a lot of ceremonies and a lot of crowds. I'll be there, but I expect it to be a pretty boring time.
When China takes control of Hong Kong, do you think that will change Chinese relationships with America or change the balance of power?
I think it's an indication that the fact that China will take over and that democracy and civil liberties will be virtually abolished or substantially cut back from day one, I think that's a very strong indication that China is increasingly winning every battle it undertakes, that the balance of power if you consider China as it really should probably be considered today as the number two superpower in the world next to the United States, China's economy, there are predictions that it will overtake the American economy by the year 2020. And if you consider China as the number two superpower, I think that the balance has been tilting from the United States to China, that China has won everything that it's undertaken.
What do you think the United States alternatives are in trying to influence China to maintain human rights in Hong Kong?
The only action that the United States has ever taken, I mean, in recent years, that has had a profound influence on China was the sending of the warships to the Taiwan Straits last March when China was launching missiles in the direction of Taiwan. I think this had a profound influence on China. No harassments of Taiwan have taken place since then. If we're led to the conclusion that the only thing that China understands is belligerent action, that's frightening. I mean, we can't threaten war at every point that China does something that we don't like. At some point, China will call our bluff. And this is the profound problem for American policymakers, to find a way to influence China and at the same time not provoke a Cold War or, for that matter, a hot war. And the Clinton administration is now trying the tactic of being nice to China and saying we're going to allow you to do what you want and we're just going to slap your hand, but we're not going to really do anything. And we hope that you'll look upon us kindly and will toss us a few bones as concessions. Now, that's never, weakness has never resulted, a demonstration of weakness rather than strength has never resulted in Chinese concessions in the past. Chinese look upon weakness traditionally as something to be exploited, not to be made concessions to. So who knows?
Well, Stan Sesser, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It was a pleasure.
Stan Sesser's article on Hong Kong is in the current edition of The New Republic. He's currently a senior fellow at the Human Rights Center at the University of California at Berkeley. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, all the anxieties of life in the 90s, and then some. Maureen Corrigan reviews Do the Windows Open? Then we meet the author, Julie Hecht. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Julie Hecht is a short story writer whose work has appeared in The New Yorker and has earned her the prestigious O. Henry Prize. She's just published her first collected volume of short stories called Do the Windows Open? You'd be right to sense a note of anxiety in that title. We'll meet author Julie Hecht after this review from our book critic Maureen Carrigan.
Over the years, I've noticed that there's very little correlation between the characters I love in fiction and the kinds of people I want to spend time with in real life. Take Jane Eyre. If she magically materialized as my downstairs neighbor, her sudden outbursts of self-righteous anger would unnerve me. I'd always be worried that my TV was on too loud for her. And Jane Austen's Elizabeth Bennet? If she were a friend, I might grow weary of laughing appreciatively at those nonstop witticisms of hers. I relish the twisted workings of Richard III's fevered brain, but I wouldn't want to be married to him. And Mary Shelley's Frankenstein is a sympathetic masterpiece of a monster, but in real life, he'd be a little hard on the eyes. Now I've added the unnamed female narrator of Julie Hecht's debut short story collection, Do the Windows Open?, to the long list of fictional characters I'd rather read about than meet. Oh, is this woman a worrywart? She's anxious about global meltdown and the accelerating process of her own over 40 facial disintegration. She sees anti-Semitism lurking behind every pair of light blue eyes and germs oozing out of bus heating ducts. I've actually met one or two Olympian neurotics like her, and they're no fun. But Hecht's fearful narrator held me spellbound. I think as my life feels more frenetic, I'm drawn to fictional characters who have the time to luxuriously probe their every dread. Even more compelling, though, is the fact that Hecht's narrator is funny. She's got the embattled comic sensibilities of a lifetime New Yorker. Woody Allen is the inevitable comparison, but there are also strains of Selma Diamond and Dorothy Parker in her voice. The 9 stories in this collection drolly recount the narrator's everyday adventures in Manhattan, as well as the Hamptons and Nantucket where she vacations. Her commentary is a monument to those rueful little thoughts most of us entertain for a second before they evaporate. For instance, in an odd tale entitled, Were the Ornaments Lovely?, she takes a trip to a drugstore where she worriedly confides to us that there was definitely something wrong with the employees of the drugstore. One of them was such a mess that when he was working at the cash register, I tried to figure out how to buy the items I'd chosen without having him touch them. And in one of the best stories, entitled The World of Ideas, she remarks on her lifetime infatuation with President Kennedy. I haven't recovered yet from watching every documentary shown for the last anniversary in November. It's especially painful to see him and then see Clinton. Just comparison of the two heads of hair is enough to bring about a sense of doom. Underneath her frivolous anxieties and satiric asides, you sense that the narrator is struggling with genuine sadness. She's a photographer, and in addition to crackpot projects like photographing flowers in every stage of disintegration, she's also spent 3 years trying to photograph her own doctor, a world-famous reproductive surgeon. But we never hear directly about the narrator's fertility problems, nor does she elaborate on the death of her mother, which, she says, caused the skin around her eyes to crumble. Hecht has created a marvelous curiosity of a character here, one who talks nonstop and cleverly, but reveals little. I hope she returns in Hecht's future stories. Unlike her real-life kvetching counterparts, I'd like to get to know this woman better.
Maureen Carrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Do the Windows Open? We wanted to find out more about author Julie Hecht, so we invited her for an interview. Usually, I ask fiction writers to read from their work, but Hecht told me she doesn't like to do readings, so I asked her why.
Because I'm so tired of it. Because I wrote it, and I edited it, and I edited all the stories for The New Yorker, and I got many sets of galleys, and I went over all the sentences and all the punctuation. And to read it aloud now, it just seems kind of narcissistic and vain.
How horrible would it be if I read a few lines out loud from your book?
Well, it would be less horrible than if I read it.
Okay. Well, I've chosen a few lines that ends with what I think is perhaps my favorite sentence in the book. This is from a story in which, this is the title story, Do the Windows Open, in which the character is very afraid about taking this bus ride, and she's just like mentally preparing herself for this ride. And she says, as the departure time approached for my first trip on the bus, I thought that this must be the way people feel when waiting to board a plane. They're always telling us that cars are more dangerous than planes. Why not be afraid of both? I love that. I think it's like the character's philosophy of life. Why not be afraid of both? In a way, I think some of the stories in here are like a catalog of phobias. Is it fair to assume that some of those phobias are yours? I'm hearing rather a long silence.
Yeah, rather not get into that.
Okay.
Other than to say that when I came here today, I asked if the windows open in this building.
And do they?
They said they can be open, but they're not open. So that was good enough for me, that they can be open. Because, you know, I've never even been to Random House, my publisher, because when I said, do the windows open, they said, no, it's a sealed building.
And why is that so important that you can't even go to the building?
Can't get any air. You know, you're separated from the air. Not that the air outside in New York is good, but what's being filtered? What kind of air is being filtered through all these sealed buildings? It just makes me feel trapped.
The character in your short stories sometimes tries to pass as a normal person. Like she says, I was talking to him as if I had normal, casual thoughts on my mind. Do you ever feel like you're trying to pass as a normal person, but you're not really?
No, because I'm used to having to act normal in life, or trying to act normal anyway. You can't just say what you're really thinking. I think everyone has some of that.
The character in your stories has an obsession with photographing her world-famous reproductive surgeon, Dr. Arnold Loquesto, and she thinks that if she photographs him with his little dog, she'd have an answer to the question of how to live in the world. Why does she think that? Why is she so obsessed with photographing this surgeon?
Well, he's a person who's not concerned with any of the little things that she's concerned with, and he can just do everything he wants to do and not get bogged down the way she does. And then the difference between his behavior with his dog and with other people is such a, I mean, not other people, I mean with people, is such a great difference that she thinks that might tell her something about how people act, how they get to do what they do. Now it's probably just something very simple, that some people like dogs better than people, and he's one of those.
You write so much about this character's obsession with photographing her reproductive surgeon, but don't really explain why she became his patient. Is she infertile? Does she really want children? Why are you not focusing on that personal aspect of her life?
Well, I don't think it matters. I don't think it's important. I think what's important is his character, him, and her fascination with his behavior and his success and how funny he is. And he's a person who's so funny that he could use his funniness to be a comedian, a writer. But here he does something worthwhile with his life.
My guest is Julie Hecht. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Julie Hecht. Her new collection of short stories is called Do the Windows Open? You've been writing stories since you were 8 years old. What did you write about when you were eight?
Same things. Same things, only a more minor version.
Well, give me an example of how an 8-year-old would be writing about this kind of frame of mind, this like fearful, neurotic frame of mind at the age of eight.
Well, I think I didn't have the fear and the neurosis in it, but I had the surprise at how different everything was from the way it was supposed to be.
How was it supposed to be?
Well, normal. You know, my childhood was in the 50s, and things were supposed to be normal. There was a facade of normal. And I noticed that things didn't live up to that. So I was always surprised that nothing was the way it was supposed to be. And I guess, I think that's what my stories were about, how this happened and that happened. And
what's an example of something that you thought was normal that didn't happen that way in your life?
Oh, like family life you'd see on television. You know, the family of Ozzie and Harriet. The family of, oh, I can't remember, those little films they'd show in school about being polite and having respect, good manners. One of the things they always showed in school was what was a healthy breakfast, and it had about it had about 10 courses in it. It had bacon, eggs, toast, butter, milk, fruit, juice, cereal, more milk, things like that. And those kind of films, I thought, well, this is not the way it is at my house.
What was going on at your house? What did your parents do? What kind of neighborhood did you live in?
My mother was an English teacher, and both my parents were social critics. My parents didn't go along with the way things were. My father would say, "I don't care what other people do. Think for yourself and do what you think is right." And they were very independent. They weren't part of what was going on wherever they lived.
Did you ever say to yourself, well, there's something inside me that's not normal, you know, that I just think differently than other people?
No, because I thought right and they thought wrong. Especially when I was, say, 13, 12, you know, I thought, what's wrong with these kids? And my father agreed with me. But someone else in my family said, you ought to read the play The Misanthrope. Because when I was at that age, I spent a lot of time telling what was wrong with my, what's called now the peer group, the people I went to school with.
Mm-hmm.
So, for you know, I thought I was right and they were wrong.
About what? I mean, what's an example of something that you thought?
Well, you know, they were just silly teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
The lipstick, the pink lipstick.
Yes.
There were these other things called fads. And all they cared about was something called being popular.
And were you ever popular, and did you ever care?
Well, I had my friends. Yeah, I think I had my friends. You know, the thing I did was I wrote stories, and my teachers read them out loud. And my classmates liked those stories. They were funny. So, or they thought they were funny. So I guess that's a kind of popularity, a popular writer in sixth grade.
In reviewing your book, our book critic Maureen Corrigan basically said that there's a certain kind of neurotic, like really, really neurotic person who could be a real chore to be around. But reading about them as a character in fiction in the way that you write about such a character, they're just fascinating and you want to spend more time with them. And I wonder if you find that difference to be true, too, that it's one thing to read about a certain type of neurotic character on a page and another thing to actually have to live with such a character or spend time with them or maybe even to be them.
I don't think it can be pinned down to a real person's behavior because it's such an exaggeration. It's more, I don't mean that my stories are as good as poems or anything like that, but when you read a poem, you wouldn't take it that seriously, would you? What they're saying about how they feel, or I think that there is no such person like this. It's a way of thinking and writing and feeling, but no one could really live that way. This is more in your head.
Tell me why you created a character who really lives in her head, whose thoughts are so preoccupied with phobias.
I don't know why. It just happened. I didn't plan it. That's just the way it happened.
Now, are your characters always like that? Have you written about characters who are real action people, who are really well adjusted?
No, I have no experience with the well adjusted.
Do you keep a journal?
No.
Oh.
Heavens.
Why is that such an appalling idea?
Well, it's enough to live through the things, but then to write it down, I don't know, it just would be... I think it's better to go out and take a walk.
A journal's like double jeopardy?
Oh, more than double.
If you could be relieved of all your fears, would you want that?
No, I think fears protect you. I mean, I don't think it's safe to fly. I don't want to learn how to fly, for example. I mean, fly in planes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand how Ralph Nader flies when he knows so many things about the danger of flying. So no, I don't believe in flying. I don't think it's natural. So I wouldn't want to be relieved of that kind of fear.
Any fears you would like to be relieved of? Like if you could be relieved of the fear of closed windows, if you could actually go to Random House, your publishing company, in spite of the fact that the windows don't open, would that feel good?
No, it's not good to be in buildings where windows can't be opened. Windows should be open. Air should come in.
So you people, think, yeah, go ahead.
People should be able to get out. They shouldn't be sealed off from the world.
So you think your fears are just sensible and rooted in reality?
Well, my fears or the narrator's fears.
Yours.
The narrator is not me. So
right.
My fears are rooted in reality. Definitely.
My guest is writer Julie Hecht. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is writer Julie Hecht, author of a new collection of short stories about anxieties and phobias called Do the Windows Open? You're the kind of writer who writes many drafts, always editing, right? I imagine every time an editor sends you a galley, you're editing it again, even if it's already been in print in another form.
I even edit it after it's published. When I get The New Yorker, I would look through it and see what I might have done better. And then I would do it again. You know, a year later, I might look at it and think I should have done this, I should have done that.
Is that a real burden to always feel like you're never done with it? Even when it's published, you're ready to improve it. You're just never done.
Well, in the beginning, it's a burden, but then you wise up and you realize it doesn't matter. First of all, you're so exhausted, you're so tired of it that you just don't care. You know, you just never want to see it again. And when people read me a sentence from it or say that they like it, I kind of don't know what they're talking about, because it's for me, it's finished. You know what I mean? I wrote these in the past, 7 years or so?
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, when I would get one of these stories published, of course it would be very exciting to me, when it would be accepted even. And then when I saw that nobody really cared very much, that they cared more about some news story, I got used to it. So that's the way it is. You know, you get used to it, and then it's not that really important. Although every time I write something, I forget about that and I attack it the same way, as if it is so important.
Where is the pleasure in writing? Writing's hard. Rewriting, you've described rewriting and editing as being like alone in a prison with your work. You're afraid that there's very few people who really appreciate writing and care much about it anymore. So where's the pleasure? Why do it?
Well, who said anything about pleasure?
Right.
Let's see. It starts out as, you know, you might make people laugh. That's what it is. When you see you made people laugh, then you feel that it's not just completely narcissistic. It's not just obsessive and selfish. Of course, it is narcissistic and obsessive and selfish, but you feel when you can make people laugh, and you see that, and you see them laughing and smiling, I suppose that's rewarding. And then when you're writing and you're under the delusion that you've written a great sentence or a wonderful sentence, you think, oh, this is fun. But then the next day when you read it, you might think, oh, it's not so great. Or then your editor will say, oh, I don't like that. That's not up to the rest of it. So you're always finding out that what you thought was wonderful is not so wonderful. You kind of never know what's what. I don't know why I do it. I guess it's just an obsession, and I feel I owe it to my sixth grade teacher who got me started.
I know you're not your character, and you don't really want to talk about any
right.
phobias you might have, yet I can't help but wonder if there are certain superstitions or fears you have as a writer that you think might jinx your writing.
Yeah, I think if you talk about it, you can't do it. Say if you get a great idea and you tell it to somebody, that's usually the end of the idea.
Mm-hmm.
Or often I'll tell someone my idea and they'll say, well, that's not a story. That doesn't sound like a story to me. In fact, I think I told my husband several of these ideas for stories that are in this book, and he would always say, yeah, well, where's the story? Because he's a man, and he's looking for action. He's looking for plot and action. In fact, one of my stories that I was having trouble with because it was so lacking in real action My fellow writer at The New Yorker, Tom Drury, read it, and it's the story in this collection, The Thrill Is Gone, and Tom really loved the story, and I said, well, what can I do to make it more this and less that? And he said, well, you should put in this sentence here, I got up.
And that's the action part?
Yeah, well, it makes it less just thinking. It gets it less out of the person's head. And at least he didn't say, you know, I got up, I got my gun, or I got up, I got on my horse. You know, I'm grateful that he said just, well, he understood the story, so he knew that that would help. And of course, it did help. And, you know, he made a few other suggestions like that.
Julie Hecht. Her new collection of short stories is called Do the Windows Open? Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu and Tracy Tannenbaum, research assistants from Siobhan Roth. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Fodors, featuring a variety of travel guides, where there's an adventure on every page. This is NPR, National Public Radio.